To Kahneman, the flight instructor's experiences rang true. On the other hand, Kahneman believed in the animal experiments that demonstrated that reward works better than punishment. He ruminated on this apparent paradox, and then it struck him. The screaming preceded the improvement, but contrary to appearances, it did not cause it. How can that be? The answer lies in a phenomenon called regression toward the mean. That is, in any series of random events, an extraordinary event is most likely to be followed, due purely to chance, by a more ordinary one. Here's how it works. The student pilots all had a certain personal ability to fly fighter planes. Raising their skill level involved many factors and required extensive practice. So, although their skill was slowly improving through flight training, the change wouldn't be noticeable from one maneuver to the next. Any especially good or especially poor performance was thus mostly a matter of luck. So if a pilot made an exceptionally good landing, one far above his normal level of performance, then the odds would be good that he would perform closer to his norm, that is, worse, the next day. And if his instructor had praised him, it would appear that the praise had done no good. But if a pilot made an exceptionally bad landing, running the plane off the end of the runway and into the vat of corn chowder at the base cafeteria, then the odds would be good that the next day he would perform closer to his norm, that is, better. And if his instructor had a habit of screaming, "You clumsy ape!" when a student performed poorly, it would appear that his criticism did some good. In this way, an apparent pattern would emerge. Student performs well, praise does no good. Student performs poorly, instructor compares student to lower primate at high volume, student improves. The instructors in Kahneman's class had concluded from such experiences that their screaming was a powerful educational tool. In reality, it made no difference at all. This error in intuition spurred Kahneman's thinking. He wondered, are such misconceptions universal? Do we, like the flight instructors, believe that harsh criticism improves our children's behavior or our employees' performance? Do we make other misjudgments when faced with uncertainty? Kahneman knew that human beings, by necessity, employ certain strategies to reduce the complexity of tasks of judgment, and that intuition about probabilities plays an important part in that process. Will you feel sick after eating that luscious-looking ceviche tostada from the street vendor? You don't consciously recall all the comparable food stands you've patronized, count the number of times you've spent the following night guzzling Pepto-Bismol, and come up with a numerical estimate. You let your intuition do the work. But research in the 1950s and early 60s indicated that people's intuition about randomness fails them in such situations. How widespread, Kahneman wondered, was this misunderstanding of uncertainty? And what are its implications for human decision-making? A few years passed, and Kahneman invited a fellow junior professor, Amos Tversky, to give a guest lecture at one of his seminars. Later, at lunch, Kahneman mentioned his developing ideas to Tversky. Over the next 30 years, Tversky and Kahneman found that even among sophisticated subjects, when it came to random processes, whether in military or sports situations, business quandaries or medical questions, people's beliefs and intuition very often let them down. Suppose four publishers have rejected the manuscript for your thriller about love, war, and global warming. Your intuition and the bad feeling in the pit of your stomach might say that the rejections by all those publishing experts mean your manuscript is no good. But is your intuition correct? Is your novel unsellable? We all know from experience that if several tosses of a coin come up heads, it doesn't mean we are tossing a two-headed coin. Could it be that publishing success is so unpredictable that even if our novel was destined for the bestseller list, numerous publishers could miss the point and send those letters that say thanks but no thanks? One book in the 1950s was rejected by publishers, who responded with such comments as very dull, a dreary record of typical family bickering, petty annoyances, and adolescent emotions, and even if the work had come to light 5 years ago, when the subject, World War II, was timely, I don't see that there would have been a chance for it. That book, The Diary of a Young Girl by Anne Frank, has sold 30 million copies, making it one of the best-selling books in history. Rejection letters were also sent to Sylvia Plath because there certainly isn't enough genuine talent for us to take notice. To George Orwell for Animal Farm because it is impossible to sell animal stories in the U.S. And to Isaac Bashevis Singer because it's Poland and the rich Jews again. Before he hit it big, Tony Hillerman's agent dumped him, advising him that he should get rid of all that Indian stuff. Those were not isolated misjudgments. In fact, many books destined for great success had to survive not just rejection, but repeated rejection. For example, few books today are considered to have more obvious and nearly universal appeal than the works of John Grisham, Theodore Geisel, Dr. Seuss, and J.K. Rowling. Yet the manuscripts they wrote before they became famous, all eventually hugely successful, were all repeatedly rejected. John Grisham's manuscript for A Time to Kill was rejected by 26 publishers. His second manuscript for The Firm drew interest from publishers only after a bootleg copy circulating in Hollywood drew a $600,000 offer for the movie rights. And Dr. Seuss's first children's book, And to Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street, was rejected by 27 publishers. And J.K. Rowling's first Harry Potter manuscript was rejected by 9. Then there is the other side of the coin, the side anyone in the business knows all too well. The many authors who had great potential but never made it. John Grisham's who quit after the first 20 rejections, or J.K. Rowling's who gave up after the first 5. After his many rejections, one such writer, John Kennedy Toole, lost hope of ever getting his novel published and committed suicide. His mother persevered, however, and 11 years later, A Confederacy of Dunces was published. It won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction and has sold nearly 2 million copies. There exists a vast gulf of randomness and uncertainty between the creation of a great novel, or piece of jewelry, or chocolate chip cookie, and the presence of huge stacks of that novel, or jewelry, or bags of cookies, at the front of thousands of retail outlets. That's why successful people in every field are almost universally members of a set. The set of people who don't give up. A lot of what happens to us, success in our careers, in our investments, in our life decisions, both major and minor, is as much the result of random factors as the result of skill, preparedness, and hard work. So the reality that we perceive is not a direct reflection of the people or circumstances that underlie it, but is instead an image blurred by the randomizing effects of unforeseeable or fluctuating external forces. That is not to say that ability doesn't matter. It is one of the factors that increase the chances of success. But the connection between actions and results is not as direct as we might like to believe. Thus, our past is not so easy to understand, nor is our future so easy to predict. And in both enterprises, we benefit from looking beyond the superficial explanations. We habitually underestimate the effects of randomness. Our stockbroker recommends that we invest in the Latin American mutual fund that beat the pants off the domestic funds 5 years running. Our doctor attributes that increase in our triglycerides to our new habit of enjoying a Hostess ding-dong with milk every morning after dutifully feeding the kids a breakfast of mangoes and non-fat yogurt. We may or may not take our stockbroker's or doctor's advice, but few of us question whether he or she has enough data to give it. In the political world, the economic world, the business world, even when careers and millions of dollars are at stake, chance events are often conspicuously misinterpreted as accomplishments or failures. Hollywood provides a nice illustration. Are the rewards and punishments of the Hollywood game deserved? Or does luck play a far more important role in box office success and failure than people imagine? We all understand that genius doesn't guarantee success, but it's seductive to assume that success must come from genius. Yet the idea that no one can know in advance whether a film will hit or miss has been an uncomfortable suspicion in Hollywood, at least since the novelist and screenwriter William Goldman enunciated it in his classic 1983 book, Adventures in the Screen Trade. In that book, Goldman quoted the former studio executive David Picker as saying, "If I had said yes to all the projects I turned down, and no to all the other ones I took, it would have worked out about the same." That's not to say that a jittery homemade horror video could become a hit just as easily as, say, Exorcist: The Beginning, which cost an estimated $80 million. Well, actually, that is what happened some years back with the Blair Witch Project. It cost the filmmakers a mere $60,000, but brought in $140 million in domestic box office revenue, more than three times the business of Exorcist. Still, that's not what Goldwyn was saying. He was referring only to professionally made Hollywood films with production values good enough to land the film a respectable distributor. And Goldman didn't deny that there are reasons for a film's box office performance. But he did say that those reasons are so complex and the path from green light to opening weekend so vulnerable to unforeseeable and uncontrollable influences that educated guesses about an unmade film's potential aren't much better than flips of a coin. Examples of Hollywood's unpredictability are easy to find. Movie buffs will remember the great expectations the studios had for the mega-flops Ishtar, Warren Beatty plus Dustin Hoffman plus a $55 million budget equals $14 million in box office revenue, and Last Action Hero, Arnold Schwarzenegger plus $85 million equals $50 million. On the other hand, you might recall the grave doubts that executives at Universal Studios had about the young director George Lucas's film, American Graffiti, shot for less than $1 million. Despite their skepticism, it took in $115 million. But still, that didn't stop them from having even graver doubts about Lucas's next idea. He called the story Adventures of Luke Starkiller, as taken from the Journal of the Whills. Universal called it unproducible. Ultimately, 20th Century Fox made the film, but the studio's faith in the project went only so far. It paid Lucas just $200,000 to write and direct it. In exchange, Lucas received the sequel and merchandising rights. In the end, Star Wars took in $461 million on a budget of $13 million, and Lucas had himself an empire. Given the fact that green light decisions are made years before a film is completed, and films are subject to many unpredictable factors that arise during those years of production and marketing, not to mention the inscrutable tastes of the audience, Goldman's theory doesn't seem at all far-fetched. It is also one that is supported by much recent economic research. Despite all this, studio executives are not judged by the bread-and-butter management skills that are as essential to the head of the United States Steel Corporation as they are to the head of Paramount Pictures. Instead, they are judged by their ability to pick hits. If Goldman is right, that ability is mere illusion. And in spite of his or her swagger, no executive is worth that $25 million contract. Deciding just how much of an outcome is due to skill and how much to luck is not a no-brainer. Random events often come like the raisins in a box of cereal, in groups, streaks, and clusters. And although fortune is fair in potentialities, she is not fair in outcomes. That means that if each of 10 Hollywood executives tosses 10 coins, although each has an equal chance of being the winner or the loser, in the end there will be winners and losers. In this example, the chances are 2 out of 3 that at least one of the executives will score 8 or more heads or tails. Imagine that George Lucas makes a new Star Wars film and in one test market decides to perform a crazy experiment. He releases the identical film under 2 titles, Star Wars Episode A and Star Wars Episode B. Each film has its own marketing campaign and distribution schedule, with the corresponding details identical except that the trailers and ads for one film say Episode A and those for the other, Episode B. Now we make a contest out of it. Which film will be more popular? Say we look at the first 20,000 moviegoers and record the film they choose to see, ignoring those diehard fans who will go to both and then insist there were subtle but meaningful differences between the two. Since the films and their marketing campaigns are identical, we can mathematically model the game this way. Imagine lining up all the viewers in a row and flipping a coin for each viewer in turn. If the coin lands heads up, he or she sees Episode A. If the coin lands tails up, it's Episode B. Because the coin has an equal chance of coming up either way, you might think that in this experimental box office war, each film should be in the lead about half the time. But the mathematics of randomness say otherwise. The most probable number of chances in the lead is 0, and it is 88 times more probable that one of the two films will lead through all 20,000 customers than it is that, say, the lead continuously seesaws. The lesson is not that there is no difference between films, but that some films will do better than others, even if all the films are identical. Such issues are not discussed in corporate boardrooms, in Hollywood or elsewhere, and so the typical patterns of randomness, apparent hot or cold streaks, or the bunching of data into clusters, are routinely misinterpreted, and worse, acted on, as if they represented a new trend. One of the most high-profile examples of anointment and regicide in modern Hollywood was the case of Sherry Lansing, who ran Paramount with great success for many years. Under Lansing, Paramount won Best Picture awards for Forrest Gump, Braveheart, and Titanic, and posted its 2 highest-grossing years ever. Then, Lansing's reputation suddenly plunged, and she was dumped after Paramount experienced, as Variety put it, a long stretch of underperformance at the box office. In mathematical terms, there is both a short and long explanation for Lansing's fate. First, the short answer. Listen to this series of percentages. 11.4, 10.6, 11.3, 7.4, 7.1, 6.7. Notice something? Lansing's boss, Sumner Redstone, did too, and for him the trend was significant, for those 6 numbers represented the market share of Paramount's motion picture group for the final 6 years of Lansing's tenure. The trend caused Business Week to speculate that Lansing may simply no longer have Hollywood's hot hand. Soon, Lansing announced she was leaving, and a few months later, a talent manager named Brad Gray was brought on board. How can a surefire genius lead a company through 7 great years and then fail practically overnight? There were plenty of theories explaining Lansing's early success. While Paramount was doing well, Lansing was praised for making it one of Hollywood's best-run studios, and for her knack for turning conventional stories into $100 million hits. When her fortune changed, the revisionists took over. Her penchant for making successful remakes and sequels became a drawback. Most damning of all, perhaps, was the notion that her failure was due to her middle-of-the-road tastes.